What exactly is the situation of this young boy?
So the 14-year-old has spent the last 2 months inside a windowless room of the emergency department at University Hospital Kerry. The North Kerry teenager was admitted on the 22nd of December and he was medically discharged by doctors shortly after. But the boy has serious mental health issues and his mother says she's unable to care for him at home without full-time supports. And the HSC, it has been trying to find a suitable place in residential care over the past few weeks, but the youngster, he remains in that room this evening, and pictures and videos show how it's strewn with rubbish, furnished solely with a mattress on the floor, and his mother claims he sometimes has restricted access to a toilet.
They said they can't put him in the children's ward because he's apparently a danger to himself and other children and workers. So they have this small room by the nurse's area, you know. He's locked in there, basically. The first month, he wasn't even going anywhere. He wasn't going for drives. He wasn't having any activities, nothing. He was just locked up in there. Just recently now, the carers go in there to take him for a drive for about 3 hours a day.
What's the room like?
Can I be honest? The animals in Dublin Zoo would be treated better. They have better comfort than my son. He wasn't having access of toilet. The bathroom was being locked on him. The excuse that was given for denying him the bathroom in the toilet was because he was banging the door. I said, well, you've taken the sink and everything else out. I said, why can't you take the door off? So the child was peeing in the room, smearing on the walls. Now, when they deliver meals, you know, it's a case of leave it on the floor. There's no bed. He just have a little mattress on the floor. I was the one that was going in most of the time doing his cleaning, even showering him, really. There's no window. There's only one door, really, that has a little glass and that's boarded up with wood. It's a tiny room with nothing in it. And they wonder why his behavior is escalating while he's in there. I mean, even a prisoner would have a toilet, wouldn't you think? You know, we're talking about a 14-year-old child. So I raised my concern to TUSLA, and the response I got was they have no authority over the hospital. How could you take away a toilet from a child?
He's approximately 60 days in that room now.
He's been in there since the 21st of December. He's still in there.
What impact do you think it will leave on him?
I try not to think about that, because if I do, can you just imagine being locked in a room for that length of time with no human contact, really?
Ultimately, families, survivors, they're left feeling forgotten, even though they themselves never forgot the events of 50 years ago, including Iris Hall, who lost her father, Archie Harper, in the Monaghan blast.
It was a long sit and wasn't allowed up to see Dad. And when I asked could I go up to see him, said no. He was queuing for theatre. They asked me to phone Mummy and I couldn't, so I phoned a neighbour, and the neighbour took Mummy to the hospital and she nearly collapsed when she realised what had happened. I just couldn't take it in. And us both going to town to do our own things and this to happen, like, you know, Daddy, he lived for 4 days but unconscious. And each day we were down with him, staying with him, hoping that he'd come round, but he didn't. And the day before he died, he put his hand out in my hand and he opened his eyes. And I was hopeful he was coming out of it, but there was nothing could be done for poor Daddy. So that was my story. My life changed that day forever. He was so close to me and I was so close to him. Went everywhere with him. My life has been horrendous because of this. You know, Daddy got it all in one side of the head, just the right hand side of the head and nowhere else. But then, on the other hand, people say to me, you could have been caught up in it too. How was he killed and not me? You know?
The quest for truth and justice still ongoing.
Yes.
How do you feel about that?
All I can say is it's been a long haul. I'm very blessed. to be still alive. I'm telling you this story. My poor mother never got justice. And I don't think I'm going to get justice either.
What can you tell us about today, Barry?
And Cormac, it is around at this exact moment, 50 years ago, May 17th, 1974, that three no-warning car bombs had just exploded here in the centre of Dublin. Devastation around Talbot Street. I'm standing here where the bomb actually detonated on Talbot Street at this time, 50 years ago, where around between 14 and 16 family members have gathered just to mark the exact moment. Around an hour and a half later, after Dublin, another bomb in Monaghan, 34 people died in all, 300 injured. Among those to die, an entire family wiped out, the O'Brien family. Today they came to remember those they lost and to reaffirm their commitment to truth and justice. Scores came to the bottom of Talbot Street, including the President, Michael D. Higgins, the Taoiseach, the Taoiseach, families from across Ireland, from as far as America, Australia, New Zealand, and from the village of Casalatico in Italy, Italian man Antonio Maglocchio among the dead in the bomb 50 years ago around now. His son returned to Ireland for the first time in five decades among those laying wreaths here at the memorial in Talbot Street.
I'm Antonio Maglocchio's son. I'm here for the memory of my father. It's the first time I came to this occasion from Italy. I don't remember my father. Very emotional, yes, very emotional.
Do you think there will be justice for those who lost their lives here? It's obviously a long time coming.
It's a very long time. Hope is the last to die, but I don't think we'll have all the justice that we should have.
I remember the last time I saw her with Madge, and because obviously she was pregnant, she was looking good, and she was looking forward to having baby Eva too, and she was going, I've got four girls, I'll be having four girls, Mama, yeah.
What's known, Barry, about the circumstances surrounding Tatenda Mokwata's death?
She gave birth to a healthy baby girl, her fourth daughter Eva, by caesarean section at University Hospital Kerry. This was at 10 to 8 on the evening of April 20th, 2022. Tatenda Mokwata died approximately 6 hours later. Rotendo, then preparing for her leaving cert, was told to come to hospital, where she both learned of her new sister and her mother's death.
When I got the call to go to the hospital by the ambulance, I really was not thinking there was something wrong. In fact, I was excited. I was very excited because I was under the impression that I would go to the hospital and I'd see my mom with Eve. I told my mom that I'd want to be the first person to see Eva after her. And she said, okay, she'll make that happen. Even though I think about it now, it is very silly. You can put it that way, that you get a phone call in the middle of the night and you're thinking everything's okay, but that's where I was. I get there and everything just, it's not what I was expecting, you see.
News was confirmed in the early hours of that morning.
Yeah, Rotendo phoned me, yes, in the early hours, and she said, are you sitting down? And I said, yes, and I think after 3 a.m., and she told me, Mom had passed away. And I said, what do you mean? You know, because he was shocked, I didn't know. I just sat there. I think I cried a lot that night. Ever since, I do cry here and there, but I've never cried like I did that day. I was home trying to book a ticket to come online. I could just stay there staring at the computer. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know. I was just like I was on autopilot. I didn't know what was happening. Yeah, because throughout the time Tatenda was in labor, she was texting me constantly to update me on what was going every time. And during the day, everything seemed to be okay. She was saying she was being taken care of during the day. Yeah, but and then she said, 6:24, Mom, I'm going for an op. I'll see you when you come when I've given the baby. And that was the last thing. So for you to hear that someone has just passed away, it's just shock. And you don't know what to do, really. Yeah.
There are so many questions that go through your mind at that stage, I'm sure.
Yes, there was, because I was thinking, how did it happen? what happened, but we didn't even know there was a baby, you know. It was like, what are you talking about? Yes, there is a baby, but mommy's gone.
We'll head to the city centre of Dublin, where our reporter Barry Lenehan is. Barry, what do you have for us?
Yes, good evening, Cormac, here right from the junction of Abbey Street and O'Connell Street here in Dublin city centre. A mixture of defiance and anxiousness here throughout the afternoon and evening, talking to people, surveying the scene. People saying to me that they've come into the city today as a show of defiance against the actions of those last night who tore the main thoroughfare of the capital asunder in those riotous scenes. But also, as I said, that anxiousness, that nervousness that we could see a repeat or some semblance of a repeat here in Dublin city centre this evening. There is a heightened Garda presence. There has been throughout the day members of the public order unit ubiquitous across from the GPO and around the spire all throughout the day. And rumours and speculation everywhere you go around the capital. I've traversed the city today. People that you meet in hospitality, local representatives, all saying might there be another protest at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, even talk of a protest around 12 noon. Now, nothing of the likes of last night has so far manifested itself in Dublin at the moment, but many workplaces telling their employees not to come into the city today. Other social events tonight cancelled as well, as the city, while perhaps more normal than one might expect given what happened yesterday, still quieter than what would be one of the big Fridays in the run-up to the festive period. Shops and businesses, some remained closed today, while other shops, workers stuck like super glue to the door, vigilant, trying to stop any repeat of those looting scenes.
Last year, David made a fresh complaint to Gardaí about this abuser. And after the documentary last year, other people came forward too with disclosures of abuse against this man. But recently, a Garda David had been dealing with called Rachel rang with significant news.
After the Late Late Show, I went up and made another statement. I remembered more on my second case. When the first time I mentioned it, I did mention him. The guards took notes and then it went to the DPP and the DPP said it was a one-on-one case, so it could go no further. So it was dropped straight away. That was finished.
The DPP dropped it back then.
Yeah.
But this time things
were
different.
This time the clock started turning a bit because I remembered more through my counselling and I went to the police and I told her more what I remembered on my second perpetrator and I gave her a long statement. The second perpetrator was around children but nothing was ever done to take him out. Even though it was just me that made the statement, it went no further and yet he was around young children. So going forward, I got the news from Rachel 3 weeks ago tomorrow, St. David, I've got news for you. And oh, great. Well, it's good and bad, she said. The good news is we were going to charge him with abuse on the three other people that came forward and yourself. But the bad news is that he died. So I burst into tears. So near, but yet so far, a bitter, bitter sweet pill to swallow, thinking this time round I might get justice and actually face him in court and eye him out. What an evil, I can't say the word, man he was. I would love to say it, but I won't say it on a radio programme. But he was an evil man. He had a Jekyll and Hyde personality. He knew how to use people. He was taught by my first perpetrator how to manipulate people and how to get in. And that's how he just then abused me. He did chloroform me.
Where did you go next with Gardaí then?
Yes, so after a bite to eat and a cup of tea, Garda Chris Lynch and Lindsay Martin, they were then driving around in a rural area when they spotted one motorist speeding and driving erratically. They went in hot pursuit and the driver continued on, veering into a property. He had a child in the front passenger seat and here's what happened.
So he's only got one brake light. He is reacting to the patrol car there. He's going, slowing the speed there slightly. Okay, no signalling, he's going right.
Okay.
He's gonna go, I'd say, is he?
Oh, chancer.
So he's trying to go into a house.
He's trying to avoid us now.
He's trying to avoid us there. I'm gonna have to jump, okay?
Yeah, jump and grab him. Let's go, quick go.
Gardaí, stop!
this off and you have failed to do so. Step out of your car. Step out of your car, sir.
Lindsay checks the driver's record on the mobile device. He's disqualified.
So what's after happening here, we tried to stop a vehicle slightly up the road, activated blue lights and sirens, the vehicle failed to stop, continued on. It was very, very close to his property, stated he didn't see us, it was impossible he did see us. So it's turned out now when we checked on the mobility device that this gentleman is actually a disqualified driver by a court disqualification. So we have a situation here now where we have a young lad, so we have to get in contact with obviously another parent to come and collect him. And obviously this gentleman has been arrested for dangerous driving because he failed to stop for us, failed to indicate, so he's been arrested for dangerous driving and also he's a disqualified driver. So
what put him on the radar originally?
It was speed. We were coming through a small village. I observed the vehicle take off at speed ahead of us, excuse me, and as he accelerated, the smoke was coming out very thick and fast out the back. There's no DOE, no tax, no insurance. Then failed to stop, I'm sure. We've dangerous driving and disqualified driving.
I've informed him that he's under arrest for dangerous driving. Because of that now, he's been arrested. I'm going to ask him for a sample of his breath and I'm also going to swab him orally with the oral fluid drug wipe test.
And that drug driving test returns a positive for opioids.
Very faint, but it's there, yeah.
Yeah, it's there. Listen, his manner of driving, lack of attention, mm-hmm. dangerous driving.
So the driver here has alleged that he's taken 2-sulpidine earlier on this evening. It has given a positive for opiates in his system. So we'll get a blood or urine sample back at the station following his arrest. We'll have a doctor there waiting.
The driver's partner arrives and gives him the hairdryer treatment. The child is brought home and the man brought to the Gartha station where he gives a urine sample.
Sure, I'll tell you how far to fill the jug up, OK?
I'll talk to it.
We'll help you with the stage fright. Have you got the Fosternalin music there?
So I'll ask you just to fill the jug out here and hand it to the doctor there.
What was the outcome here then, Barry?
Yes, so the driver's urine was sent also to the Medical Bureau of Road Safety for further examination.
What happened then?
On September 1st, Fionn was assaulted by the same resident again. According to a report by the service provider, which I have seen, the other resident ran into Fionn's room when he was sleeping and locked himself in the bedroom for approximately 4 minutes. This meant the young person was unsupervised with Fionn in the locked room. Staff on duty, they shouted for them to leave Fionn's room but were unable to immediately unlock the door or see inside as to what was happening.
And do we know what happened?
The incident report states how staff at the centre continued to bang on Fionn's bedroom door, requesting the perpetrator, who was laughing, to unlock the door. They could hear Fionn repeating the words, "No, no, no." It goes on to state that the other young person could be heard moving around the room and Fionn crying from behind the locked door. The 12-year-old could be heard repeating, "No, no, no," for a second time as he continued to cry.
Go on.
And just a further warning at this point that we're about to discuss details that listeners may find distressing. But this review by the service provider states how eventually the perpetrator unlocked the door and ran out with his pants down around his ankles and his genitals exposed. Staff at the centre, they'd been unable to get into the room for the duration of the assault. When they entered the room, they found Fionn with his pyjama bottoms down, and the review describes how there was faeces smeared on his face, head, hair and chest. The centre didn't tell the mother of the September incident for 3 days. It didn't inform Tuzla for 3 days either, nor tell the Gardaí for 11. The boy's mother desperately wants answers for what happened and reassurances it won't happen again to Fionn or indeed to any other child. And so, with all this in mind, I've been speaking to the Minister of State for Disabilities, Anne Rabbitt.
I was very shocked with what I had heard and what I have read. I'm very disappointed and very concerned, to be quite honest with you, Barry. And I cannot imagine how the family feel in this situation whatsoever. And also, like, it's not acceptable. Let me be very clear about that. This is not acceptable. And that's one of the reasons why on the follow-up to what has been published in the last 24 hours, I'm going to organise a meeting with the HSE in Tuzla. But I'm also going to reach out to the family to have a meeting with them to get answers. I think there's a need for a lot of answers here. There needs to be clarity brought to the situation as to how this happened and how we had repeated incidents as well. I can't stand over that. Carry on.
When did you become aware of what happened?
Came aware of it yesterday when RTÉ reported on it. That was the first it had crossed my desk.